This beautiful weather makes it so much easier. Teaching retreats when it's raining and everyone's indoors is much more difficult. So thank you. However it works. When we begin this practice, we make effort from wrong understanding, a certain amount of ignorance, because our insights are limited, and so like when I started practice those years ago, I was very willful and very determined, and that's the only way I knew how to make effort to become, effort to get rid of, effort to attain. So it was vigorous, but it was sometimes it was peaceful, but most of the times it's just frustrating. Sometimes it would work, sometimes it wouldn't work, and then I'd have the memory of when it worked, and I would try to manufacture that same state of mind, and then it wouldn't work. And I think that's a common struggle that we have around right effort. And then as we do this practice and this work, then we become more intelligent. You know, we begin, our understanding begins to inform our efforts, not just an opinion or a perception of how you have to do it. We actually become informed about right effort through making mistakes, through trying, through experimenting, through failing. And that's a kind of natural process of wisdom and discernment and intelligence that comes about. So right understanding feeds right effort. But wrong effort, if it's done through a kind of contemplative way, wrong effort has its purpose, doesn't it? We don't know. We kind of go for it and give it a go. So the teachings that we get around meditation and around understanding and so on are in the beginning intellectual, that might be attractive, but we have to allow those teachings, say, to be a kind of avenue of investigation. I was thinking about orthodoxy, how in practicing in a very orthodox tradition, one can have opinions about what all this is about. You know, so you have the authorities, the scholars, or the enlightened beings who say you have to do it this way or you have to do it that way. And you get a kind of orthodox mindset coming down through a tradition. Now, I don't know, perhaps you're not so orthodox as I am, but we're certainly affected that way because we've taken on this tradition rather wholeheartedly. And there's a danger in orthodoxy in that it becomes a kind of narrowness of focus, like a provincialism, kind of a this is the only way, kind of almost cultish. You can get that way. So then we have this word orthopraxy. You know, orthopraxis is the authentic doing of a doctrine or a teaching or a particular way, and orthopraxis has to lead to liberation. So if one's understanding leads to views and opinions and positions and remains stuck in that, then one is stuck, one is really stuck. So taking a teaching and enlivening it through our efforts, using a teaching that gives us a kind of avenue into the way things are. If you don't have any teaching, no teaching, you just have a book of aphorisms and clever sayings. So you've got Rumi sayings, which are clever, and you have Kahil Gibran sayings, which are clever, maybe some Ajahn Chah sayings, which are clever, and then some maybe Jack Kornfield sayings, which are clever. So you have all these clever sayings, which can inspire the mind, right? But do you does one have a whole? Is one's understanding a set piece? Like, doesn't really make sense? In other words, do you understand the project? Because it is a project that we're involved in. Do you really understand why we do what we do? Why the teaching lays out the Four Noble Truths, the Five Khandhas, dependent origination, three characteristics, all these different teachings. Is it a set? Is it a set that one understands wholly as a whole set? If one's intelligence has that kind of a whole understanding, that even if it's somewhat, if it's off in some places, if you get some information that comes into that that challenges that, then you have to really think deeply, well, wait a minute, what is my understanding? What is my viewpoint? And then if it has to get reordered, okay, you have to go right down to the ground and reorder it, and you're like, oh yeah, that was wrong. It was wrong understanding. But it's of a whole set piece. But if one's intellectual take on this is kind of bits and pieces, you know, kind of an eclectic amalgam of inspiring phrases and interesting viewpoints, it doesn't necessarily edify. It can inspire, but it doesn't necessarily edify. So in terms of like effort, you get things like, you don't have to make any effort, you're already enlightened. That can make sense in some way, in the way that non-desire, non-grasping, non-becoming is important. But if you don't understand, and you know that statement, you can't take it into a larger context of right understanding and right effort, then it, you know, it can just lead to a sort of hubris of, well, yeah, I'm ready to enlighten, pass the joint, right? I don't need to do anything. So if you have a good intellectual structure, and it doesn't just limit you to sort of an orthodoxy of opinions and conceit, you know, the conceit of orthodoxy, the conceit of a particular tradition, if it doesn't bind you in that way, then it gives you a really good framework for now investigating the way things are. And that's why we have a teacher. That's why we have the Buddha, who lays out a teaching. And for us in Theravada, we do think that the Pali Canon is the closest approximation we can get to that teaching. Well, you could argue, well, no, there's others. Okay, but what is your approach? And does one have faith in a teacher? And what is the point of a teacher? It seems to me you have a teacher because the teacher has some insight and some way of explaining that insight, which would be very, very helpful. You go to a master carpenter because the master carpenter has done the work and give you some help in becoming a carpenter yourself. So the danger of orthodoxy is just a kind of narrow-minded attachment and an opinionatedness and a kind of sectarianism. And then the danger of not having any intellectual structure, any right understanding, even intellectually, is that one just wanders around in a kind of haphazard way. One doesn't really have a kind of ujjo directness of practice. And right understanding is both, you know, kind of you begin with like picking up some ideas and then you try some stuff out, and then it's enhanced by practice, by insight. And one has a sense, you know, one works on something, yeah, that makes sense. And the more you practice in a sincere way, I think, the more those teachings become richer. And you go, oh yeah, you would have read something and maybe not really quite understood it, kind of understood it, and then you'll be practicing, and then this insight will arise. Oh yeah, that's what that means. And you go back to it and you look at it, and it, you know, kind of deepens and confirms your sense of right understanding, and then you apply that. So right understanding is both, you could say it has an intellectual component and it has an insightful component that eventually merge into liberation. In terms of right effort, in the beginning, when one tries this work out, then the recommendation is to really understand the five hindrances, because those are very skillful ways of describing what prevents the capacity to stay with the way things are. So you basically have, I look at it as three things. One is energy, and that is sleepiness and restlessness, dullness and restlessness. And for me, that's about vitality. The possibility of understanding life requires a kind of vitality or a brightness. And dullness and restlessness are the hindrances to that. So that's a kind of basic struggle that we all have as we try to meditate. What is the right sense of vitality? So you can see, if I'm trying too hard, I'm just putting too much effort forth, and body's strained and mind's strained, it just, you know, I can't sustain this. And if my mind is just dull and sleepy, then I can't be there. So we swing between those two, try to understand them. And once there's understanding of that through the struggle, then that becomes part of right understanding. Yeah? Right understanding, you understand how to work the energies of consciousness, how to bring forth brightness or bring forth relaxedness according to time and place, according to necessity. So then right effort, right understanding. Right understanding is deepened now. So it's no longer just the text saying, well, you know, you have to let go of dullness, and you already know that. But it's actually now informed by your experience. And that's insight or understanding or intelligence. And then the other pair that I like to think of is just love and hate. The sense of, like I was using words like resistance, anticipation, love and hate, trying to get something, trying to get rid of something. That's a basic duality which exists in the way we make effort. And that's a big one too, isn't it? Where you're trying to, you know, when I started, the only reason you'd make effort is to get enlightened. So I'm going to get enlightened, whatever that, didn't have a clue what that meant, but I'm going to get something. And the present state of mind is certainly not enlightened. So I have to get rid of that one. And that's a simplification, but that's kind of how quite often we start. This has to be annihilated, and then in some future possibility I'll get that golden prize, which I read about and hear about and I'm supposed to attain as a bhikkhu. And that whole preconception then conditions my effort. I no longer observe the way things are. I'm already coming from a bias, coming from an opinion, coming from an orthodoxy maybe. You know, these things you have to attain and these things you have to get rid of. And then I apply, and then I try to fit my own mind into a set of academic principles or views and opinions, rather than look at how really is the mind, and then maybe use the teaching to reflect on, oh, where is that in that? So then I try to fit in to a preconceived notion, my own conscious experience, and then I'm already in the past. I'm already in a kind of judgmental mode, because I'm just analyzing now, I'm not really with the way things are. But if you just take that basic, those principles of love and hate, resistance, anticipation, trying to get rid of, and just try to understand that, what is that, and investigate and understand and get some insight, then you begin to have right understanding around that, and then effort is again conjoined with right understanding. Right understanding informs right effort. So then as you practice, you see that, you know that, you know how that works, and your practice always goes to the middle between those extremes of trying to become and trying to get rid of. So that's a big piece, right? And then doubt is the fifth hindrance. I mentioned these before, but doubt for me is always the fallback to intellect being the final arbitrator of how you're doing it. Intellect being the final judge of whether it's right or wrong. But intellect isn't the same as experience. When I practice and the result is calm and steady and bright, I know that. I don't have to have an opinion about it. So the doubting mind always tends to be the thinking mind. It's always going into thought in whatever ways. And so the hindrance of doubt is not that you don't have doubt. Doubt is a natural condition, but that you no longer seek to find calmness through thought. You no longer believe in the thinking mind with all its different questions and so on. And then you have the intellect in perspective. So then you can use intellect and you can ask a question to your mind. Okay, you know, what is becoming? What does becoming feel like? And then you watch and you observe. So the question is fine, but the answer isn't through intellect. The answer is more like a scientific answer which comes from the data. I see. And so the insight can come from a question, but the insight isn't an intellectual answer. And then afterwards you might get an intellectual answer, you might get an analysis. So doubt is the great hindrance for doubters, for people who rely a lot on intellect and thought and those kinds of attitudes. So in terms of thought, how do you use thought to direct your attention? How do you let go of thought and sustain attention? And you begin to see the importance of that. So like if you're waiting for lunch and then you're thinking about something, why? Why does the mind always do that? You're just waiting here and the mind just goes off and thinks about something. And you begin to appreciate, oh, that's just attachment to thought. And rather than trying to get rid of thought, the mind, your attention begins to open to space, silence, rather than to be narrowly focused or caught up or limited by the projections and all this thinking stuff that we can do. So in terms of hindrances, love and hate, where we get distracted, in terms of love and hate, as we pick up the pleasant. So what is it that you enjoy entertaining yourself with? We dwell in the averse, resentments and so on. So there's kind of two levels. There's the level of just being distracted by entertaining thoughts or averse thoughts. But also there's the level of making effort from that. It's a kind of deeper level. That's more difficult. Oi. Sha. Straighten that, that's it. So, what you find, I think, then, is that the need for effort, the kind of effort, becomes more and more refined. In the beginning, you make vigorous, like even just in one meditation, you might make a vigorous effort just to like count your breaths. You do something like that, you're kind of really out of it, and you're going, okay, just count your breaths, count each out breath. Go to 10, if you can't get to 10, start again. And just do something simple like that. Or you just do something very, very coarse, like deep breathing. Or you just stretch the old spine out as much as you can. So sometimes effort is very, very obvious and coarse like that. But once those energies are settled, once you understand the issues of resistance and becoming, then that effort is no longer necessary. It's not, you know, your mind easily abides clear of the hindrances. And as it abides like that, then you get more subtleties. You know, you get to just like last night we were reading Lompo Liam's description of his enlightenment and how he walked for 16 hours of meditation and he sat for 8 hours. For those of you who weren't here, we were reading that. But so you think, wow, I have to sit for 8 hours. As soon as you say that, you're finished, aren't you? Or even if you say, I have to sit for 1 hour. I remember when I first did one of those Mr. Goenka retreats, and that, you know, just the teacher saying, you can't move for 1 hour. made me incredibly tense. Okay. And yet if you just say, well, just listen for an hour, you know, there's a whole different framework there, isn't there? So if I say to you, oh, to get enlightened, you cannot move for 8 hours. And then you get the self-view coming up, I must not move for 8 hours, and you're really tense. But if you're, you know, if you understand the hindrances and you can kind of put those down, your mind's fairly present, and you just say, well, just listen for the rest of the sitting. Nowhere to go. You know, that's doing the same thing, but now it's with an attitude of relaxed attention rather than this kind of gripping determination. So the effort you make depends on where you're at right now, in the day, in the sitting, in your practice over your lifetime. And no, you know, you have to figure out for yourself. There's no one way to do it. But the idea is to see cause and effect, to try things, to experiment, to not be caught just in views and opinions, that I have to do this or I can't do that, and actually try something and then you'll see what works for you. If you can, if the mind does settle down and you can, then just, I would suggest you can just start with like listening and just seeing, just be that listener. Very simple, nowhere to go, nothing to do. And that's not a kind of philosophy of I'm already enlightened. No, it's an attitude. It's an attitude that you're suggesting to consciousness rather than a philosophical position that you're already enlightened. That's an opinion. But actually an attitude is more something that is quite alive and flexible, and you use language to create an attitude in the mind, to help you create an attitude in the mind. So I say, just nothing to do. Now then, if you leave this retreat and say, well, Viridhamma said there's nothing to do, you know, that's not it, is it? It's like, no, it's a suggestion. So if someone is like really, really dull and sleepy, so why don't you try some walking meditation? Yeah, there's something to do, something to be done. So how do you use language, not just as opinions and positions, but as skillful suggestions? And that's the beauty of language. When you can, like the words I use, obviously, is the language that works for me, but when I can say non-anticipation, I find that really helpful, because that creates a kind of mirror for my own tendency to try to get something or whatever. Non-resistance towards discomfort and pain. Yeah? So it's just a word, but the word is coming from insight. It's coming from my own experimentation. So it's coming from my own understanding. And the word works, so it comes from a right understanding. So the same way with you, these words are not necessarily your words. They don't necessarily work for you. But what kind of words would fit your own insights? You know, when you get some kind of sense of the correctness of effort, what kind of language might help you to remember and recollect that? Not reproduce it and manufacture it with greed, but just recollect, oh yeah, that was the attitude. And a lot of it is around that. And then sustaining that, encouraging, using language in that way. That's not judgmental, it's not analytical, it's reflective language. Then it leads to silence. Okay, let's do some meditation.